It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and we begin your Friday morning by responding to a listener request. It was a couple of weeks ago now that we took an hour from this program to ask you what you wanted to hear from us. And here's Erin from Madison.
I have a child with autism, so I think it would be really important to hear from experts in the field or even parents and healthcare providers about how to be more aware early in your child's life to the signs of autism and how to get help in Wisconsin particularly.
So the team here at the morning show got right to work on following through on Erin's request. And by right to work, I mean 15 minutes after this show. Our guest this morning works with families to help with diagnostic evaluations and behavioral assessments. So we'll ask you to join the show. And how has your own understanding of the autistic spectrum and our own neurodiversity evolved over time? What stories do you have to share this morning about being diagnosed on the autistic spectrum, or stories of our families and friends? We invite you to call us at 1-800-642-1234. We invite you to email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Kristen Wagner, clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona, outside of Eau Claire. Kristen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Lee, and happy Autism Awareness Acceptance Day.
So let's start there then, Kristen. What can we do to acknowledge this day and those who have been diagnosed on the autistic spectrum?
Oh, what a great question. I think number one is going beyond awareness and really moving towards the acceptance, recognizing that autism isn't something bad, isn't something that needs to be fixed or cured, and embracing neurodiversity and looking at how we can make accommodations in our communities and in our world to help autistic individuals be more comfortable in their own skin.
Well, we spoke with you last June, Kristen, about how the pandemic has affected operations at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. And give us an update now on how your work is going day to day.
Yeah, I am busy. Fortunately, my staff and I are all fully vaccinated. So we have been back full time, face to face with all of our kiddos. And that has just been absolutely wonderful. We have a lot of ground to catch up.
Well, and how has this last year been a struggle for the work that you do?
Yeah, I think in some ways, individuals with autism didn't struggle as much as some of the rest of us. They live every day in chaos and struggling with changes in routine and things being moved in the grocery store and all of the unexpected daily things that we don't even notice. And so I think we got a little window into an autistic person's world when we had to deal with lockdowns and shutdowns and changes in our routines. But for an individual with autism, sometimes that social isolation is almost preferred. Not that they don't want friends and don't want to make, but it's hard for them. And so that shutdown was a little bit easier, but caused more problems now because it's such a dramatic change, and especially for our little guys. If we think of those toddlers and preschoolers in those early years, when you're learning about what a cow is or what a horse is, if you only see it on screens and you haven't gone to the zoo or the farm or the petting zoo to experience life, trying to learn and understand the world around you when you are living in your four walls can be extraordinarily difficult.
Kristen Wagner, our guest, clinical psychologist on this World Autism Awareness Day, where we're moving from awareness to more acceptance. And as I go to the website for autismspeaks.org, Kristen, I see the lighted up blue, wear blue, and kindness April 2nd in support of understanding and acceptance for people with autism. And the page at autismspeaks.org has a common refrain, and that common refrain is kindness. And maybe it's clear to you, Kristen, but what role does kindness play in the way that we treat our own neurodiversity?
Oh, somewhat of a loaded question. I think as a psychologist, my answer to that is first and foremost, we need to be kind to ourselves. And if we can learn to accept our own mistakes, our own struggles that we have, and then can embrace those little pieces of faults in ourselves, we will have a better chance to be kind to someone else and to get that tiny little glimpse, that window into what it must be like to live in a world that is so overstimulating and so confusing. And so if we can embrace and acknowledge ourselves and our own weaknesses and our own faults, I think it's easier to truly have empathy and be kind to someone else.
So it starts with kindness to yourself?
I think it does. More the acceptance and awareness of faults. Because if we can acknowledge that we have tantrums, we have meltdowns, we're going to be able to not judge and to be kind. So if a child is having a meltdown, and I'm not talking a tantrum because a child didn't get what he wants, but a meltdown because maybe they moved the cereal from where it was last week, and a child with autism just doesn't understand where is their cereal. And so that child might be having a meltdown, and people stop, they stare, they point, oh, what bad parents, horrible kinds of things that my families and parents have said that people have said to them. And so if we recognize our own faults and our own weaknesses and how we address, maybe that can help to be kind and to not judge others.
Kristen Wegner, do you think those who are autistic are discriminated against because of their symptoms?
Yes and no. I think that there is a stereotype of what autism is, and I think that some people are discriminated against because they're not autistic enough, which there is no such thing, because there is no such thing as high-functioning or low-functioning. Autism is autism, and it's a spectrum, and every autistic expresses their autism in a different way. And so I think the biggest discrimination comes from having this narrow window or view of what someone perceives autism. And so I was just talking with a group of friends I have on Instagram and posting a what does autism look like, and asking them, autistics themselves and parents of autism, what hurtful things they hear. And some of those are, oh, he's not autistic because he talks, because he looks at me, because he doesn't flap. Well, girls can't be autism. He's too smart. And so I think that discrimination sometimes comes because people have a misconception of what autism should look like.
And is that because, at least to some degree, we had originally understood autism as a binary on or off switch, as opposed to a spectrum where we now, as we continue to understand neurodiversity, we all fall along some sort of spectrum of our nerves?
Absolutely. And I think 40 years ago, 50 years ago, individuals diagnosed with autism were diagnosed with autism that also had cognitive impairments, and so there was a dual diagnosis. And we know that autism doesn't affect intelligence, and so there, that spectrum is not about intelligence.
Kristen Wegner is our guest, clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. And we'd be interested in hearing from you this morning. April is Autism Awareness Month, and this is World Autism Day. And your questions, your comments about the autistic spectrum and our own neurodiversity at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation with Kristen continues next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You know, if you think your fingerprint's unique, you should check out your brain. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're exploring our own neurodiversity this morning and the importance of identifying it at an early age and treating it with kindness and understanding, knowing that the result is most typically a happy and full life. What questions do you have this morning about the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder? What stories do you have this morning to share about people who have had this diagnosis? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to the studio. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Kristen Wegner is a clinical psychologist in Western Wisconsin with over 30 years' experience, and she stays with us this morning. Kristen, we've been in this pandemic for a year now, and I know one of the important elements of treating the autistic spectrum is early diagnosis. How hard has it been to achieve an early diagnosis when we have been so isolated for a year?
I think that in one way, we have been fortunate because the pandemic forced insurance companies to rethink what they allowed. And so now telehealth is an allowable service. And while that isn't necessarily the best treatment modality for diagnostic, it actually has been a beneficial tool. First of all, when I do a diagnosis, I need to meet with the parents and get a detailed history of a child's development, because even though autism can be diagnosed at any age, symptoms must present within those first 3 years. So we need to get a detailed history. And that can be difficult when a parent brings a child into the office and you're trying to have an interview when the child is present. And so being able to do a telehealth when the child is napping and talking with the parent, and the parent is more comfortable in their own home. So I think that has been a benefit. And then also being able to see the child in their environment has been helpful, but certainly a disadvantage in that I am not directly able to see how the child is responding to me, because a toddler or a preschooler is not that tuned in to wanting to play toys with some two-dimensional person on a screen.
That makes sense, Kristen. And so increased access is an opportunity. Would you recommend that every child undergo a behavioral assessment? And if so, at what age? What should parents look for?
I don't think every child, but certainly if a parent has any inkling, any thought that this doesn't seem like what I expected or what I read about, my child is not playing peekaboo, or my child is opening and shutting doors repeatedly, or is not looking at me. And we can go through some more of those early signs, but I would want any parent who has any of those gut feelings to get a diagnosis, because, again, not that I want to change who an autistic person is or fix or cure, but I would love to be able to alleviate the anxiety and the overwhelming and any kinds of behavioral problems that result because a person can't navigate the world around them or can't communicate. And so with that early diagnosis, we can help to alleviate some of the later problems.
How early?
12 months is probably the earliest that I can diagnose. So it's pretty young.
Kristen Wegner, as a clinical psychologist, when this is a listener request from Aaron, who has a child who's been diagnosed on the autistic spectrum, where can parents go for more help? Where can they get support? How can, and you know, every parent's going to want to do whatever they can for their child, so what can they do?
Yeah, there are actually very few psychologists that do autism evaluations. So getting that evaluation can be difficult. 10 years ago, I didn't even do evaluations because I didn't want to both evaluate and treat. But the waiting lists at the bigger clinics were getting so long that parents were waiting up to 6 months or a year just to get a diagnosis. And then that child, if they had autism, was losing that critical period of development. So I think there are resources, and the Greater Autism Society in Wisconsin has a great site that can link families to the different resources in their specific area. But I think it is not taking no for an answer. There's a very few of us that are qualified to do autism diagnosis, and so seeking out that person that is very knowledgeable and has experience, because it can be difficult to see in a 12-month-old or an 18-month-old, but that's when we would ideally want to do that diagnosis as young as possible.
So parents, does your child have special needs or has been diagnosed on the autistic spectrum? And what's it been like guiding them through this pandemic? How have you explained the coronavirus? And you know, as we're all trying to find our way through this, are you a teacher who's worked with autistic children? We'd want to hear from you before our conversation's over here at the bottom of the hour at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen, when we look towards, and I want to mention that we'll put the links for help and networking with the autism group in Wisconsin on our webpage at WPR.org/mornings. One of the aspects of people who've been diagnosed on the autistic spectrum disorder that I want to bring up is their sense of humor, because their sense of humor is my sense of humor. It makes me laugh with their puns and their wit, and sometimes I think people don't think that but people on the autistic spectrum disorder, they're funny. They have a sense of humor about the anxiety that, as we started the conversation, many of us can relate to through the experiences we went through this past year, and the ratcheting up of our own anxiety is a little bit of a window to what it could be like to be diagnosed on the autistic spectrum. So give me some feedback on that.
I'm going to say that, you know, each person's sense of humor, I think, is as unique as they are. I think I know individuals with autism who are humorous, and I know others who don't get humor. So I think that also varies for every individual. Humor can be a very difficult thing for a lot of autistics to understand because of the abstractness of it, and so individuals with autism are often very concrete thinkers. And so even the other day I was doing something silly and I said, I've lost my marbles, and my autistic child said, "Oh my gosh, not your marbles, I will help you find them," which is wonderfully humorous, but it's because I was using this figurative language that he took literally. And so while we can chuckle, I can't imagine what it's like to go through the world to misunderstand. And so I think sometimes autistics can end up being the butt of a joke. And it goes back to that discrimination that you were talking about, that if you don't quite get things or you say things that are a little bit off, they might not have meant to have been funny.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Allison in Rhinelander has a question for you this morning. Kristen, Allison, you're on the morning show.
Good morning. I want to thank you for the work that you're doing. There's a controversy about whether autism is connected with vaccines. And I think there's substantial information on both sides of the issue. However, if there is such a controversy, why has the vaccine court awarded parents of autistic children with substantial sums of money? That's my question.
Sure. Thank you, Allison, and I appreciate your kind words. I am not familiar with research supporting a connection between autism and vaccines. There had been some research, but all of that research has been debunked, and actually the individual who started that lost his medical license because there is more research that shows that there is no link between vaccines and autism.
So, Kristen, looking into the future then, how might a parent of a child with autism explain the vaccine process when it's time to get immunized?
Yeah, there's some great books that have been just published in the last year about germs, about coronavirus, and learning about what a virus does and what germs do and how we can stay safe is, I think, the first step in beginning that process. And then we do lots of little practice. We talk about getting that big poke, and we set up a pretend doctor office, and we practice poking with our finger and then a toothpick. And we practice our behavioral regulation strategies so that when the child goes to get a shot or a vaccine or a blood draw or any of the medical procedures that can be so overwhelming, that child knows what to expect and is able to have already practiced how to calm their bodies and how to deal with that anxiety provoking and somewhat, you know, painful for some individuals.
Kristen Wagner, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and happy World Autism Day.
Thank you so much, Lee. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Kristen Wagner is a clinical psychologist working with children who have autism. And thanks to Aaron from Madison for suggesting we talk about autism on the program. If you have an idea for the morning show, visit us at WPR.org/mornings or email ideas at WPR.org. Be sure to mention your name and city, like Aaron from Madison, and thank you, Aaron, so we can thank you on the air. Up next is news and a story of our Wisconsin life. Then we look at two of this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. Have you seen Mank or The Trial of the Chicago 7? What do you think of these flicks? Join our conversation next at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and every Friday in April, we'll be taking you to the movies with our look at this year's Academy Award nominees for Best Picture. We're going to begin this morning with Aaron Sorkin's Trial of the Chicago 7 and David Fincher's Mank. And after this look at our Wisconsin life this morning, here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a special Central Wisconsin space.
There's a place in Ripon that's providing a space for musicians and artists to get as creative as they want to. At the Heist, organizers have converted a former bank into a community space that they hope will bring people together. Aisha Jaffer recently spent a weekend there and introduces us to the makers at the Heist.
Sam Luna is a musician, creator, and educator. He's traveled across the nation searching for his artistic home in places like New Mexico and L.A., with the goal of starting a project that amplifies a greater artist community.
I'd always wanted to be a part of an art project. You know, I really thought that talking about Wisconsin, I find myself more inspired here than most places I go to.
It was actually love that brought Luna to Wisconsin, but his passion for the creative community keeps him here. His first experience was in Kenosha, booking shows from music to spoken word. It's also where he found music.
I quit a job one day without even thinking about it. I had written one song and figured I would just try it. And that was 15 years ago. And that's where I started doing music and art.
Well, I've been on the road for 10 years now. Forgotten where I really want to go. Forgotten where I want to call home.
Sam's music took him all around the state, but when he was asked to play in Ripon, he had no idea his life was about to change.
So I took the road in, turned the corner, saw this building, and I got goosebumps. I saw the downtown, really beautiful community. There's only been, you know, three places that have made me feel that way in all the different travels.
Sam became fascinated with that building. A year later, he acquired what is now the art space known as the Heist. Before this, the building had taken on many forms as an opera house, venue, and a bank. Its time as a bank tied directly into a piece of Luna's family history and his grandmother.
She played music, you know, some jazz music at night, rob banks during the day. She found herself in a situation where she thought the only way to provide for herself or her family was through robbing a bank. And here came an opportunity to be able to take a bank and give it back to the community.
I had the pleasure of spending the night at the Heist, and inspiration was radiating throughout its walls.
It's a place to create, inspire, educate, and collaborate, and using those in every bit of the arts, through food, through textiles, through music, through art, through community, a place to be able to come together, learn together, and inspire each other. That's really what I want people to come in and feel from the space.
During my stay, I was able to speak to some of the talent who are currently using the space, like musician Tay of Green Bay.
It makes it more colorful here, and I don't mean that like just in an artistic way. I think that the diversity that we bring in from different people from different cultures and just different mindsets, people aren't used to that here. And so I think that's like one of the most valuable parts.
While Tay rehearses with her band in the main lobby, I find Aaron Dusterheff in another part of the building called the Hideout. He's the resident audio engineer and recording Tay from one level above us.
I've met so many people doing this project that I would never have. I've dabbled in art the way I never have. It brings people together in a really intangible way, I guess.
During this pandemic, Luna says the Heist continues to support and highlight the artist community all throughout Wisconsin.
Musicians, artists, sound engineers, lighting crew. There are so many different people that are affected with this shutdown, that are involved with the arts. And remember that each individual person is a small business. And so let's find ways to come together to help those small businesses. And I think that's what the goal of this space is to do, is try and gather people together and help, even if it's to bring awareness.
That story on the Heist in Ripon came to us from Aisha Jaffer, a storyteller based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
All right, now let's go to the movies. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and every Friday in April, we're going to be focusing on two of this year's Best Picture nominees, leading up to the 93rd Academy Awards, Sunday, April 25th. Our first film leads all films this year with 10 nominations, including Gary Oldman for Best Actor and Amanda Seyfried for Best Supporting Actress as Marion Davies in Mank.
I heard Pops on the phone helping to pick the president's cabinet like casting a movie. They can stop a guy like Sinclair. Couldn't you, Pops? Pardon. I don't know what I'm saying.
It's Amanda Seyfried as Marion Davies, referring to Pops, William Randolph Hearst, the focus of of the movie Citizen Kane, which is the focus of Mank. Early morning movie critics can get their reviews in now, as well as their Oscar predictions, by calling 1-800-642-1234 or emailing us ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Anna Thompson-Hodgick. She's a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater and teaches courses on film. Anna, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so this first movie we're talking about this morning would have been, you would think, huge on the big screen, done in the way that Orson Welles did Citizen Kane, black and white with big sweeping scenery and looming shadows. And yet we all sat at home and streamed it on Netflix this year. It is a little bit of a different experience at the movies.
It is, yeah. And, you know, that is something that is, you know, kind of a common thread through a lot of these films this year. We have to watch them at home for the most part. And there are a few of them that have had theatrical releases, but you know, because of the pandemic, you know, most movies, people just aren't comfortable going to movie theaters. And so, I watched this in my home theater, and you know, it is a spectacular film in terms of its cinematography, the way it shot, the crispness of the picture. But I would have loved to have actually seen it in a theater as well. So as opposed to my home theater. So it's just a different year in terms of these films, how they're being distributed and gotten out to film buffs and movie audiences more broadly. And it remains to be seen, you know, is that going to really impact as well the audience numbers for the Academy Awards this year?
So Mank is about the screenwriter of the film Citizen Kane by Orson Welles, and it's based on a historical adaptation, the film directed by David Fincher, who's also nominated for Best Director in this nominee for Best Film. Now, I'm sure, Anna, you've taught Citizen Kane, right? So how does that prism impact your viewing of Mank?
Well, I will say this. Mank is very much a kind of an insider film. I was kind of surprised just at how much kind of insider knowledge I think one might need to truly enjoy Mank in terms of, you know, who the cast of characters are. And if you know the details of the background of Citizen Kane, I think you do have sort of a richer cinematic experience. And, you know, Orson Welles, you know, really battled to get that film made and had lots of opposition in terms of course, Hearst, who, really tried to attempt a smear campaign against Orson Welles. And, you know, having some of that background knowledge is definitely going to provide you with, a deeper understanding of Mank for sure. And, you know, it's interesting in terms of just the technological elements of Mank. The cinematography is incredible. And the cinematography is very much an ode to Greg Toland, who was the cinematographer on Citizen Kane. And that cinematographer's name is Eric Messerschmidt. And he is somebody that doesn't have a real long track record of being a film cinematographer, but he had worked with Fincher on a number of Fincher's smaller projects. Kind of his biggest credit is Fincher's television program Mindhunter, which also you can also see on Netflix. And so, you know, I do think that, again, having some familiarity with kind of Hollywood of the 1930s, early 1940s, is going to provide you with, again, a deeper understanding of the plot points of the film, for sure.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, our guest, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaches courses on film and a film buff in her own right. And a couple of acting nominations for Mank: Gary Oldman for Best Actor. He's already won in his role as Winston Churchill in The Darkest Hour. And Amanda Seyfried in a Best Supporting Actress role in Mank, and it's her first Academy Award nomination. What did you think of these actors and what they brought to this to the screen?
Well, I think, you know, Gary Oldman is, you know, he's kind of, you know, an actor that has clearly, you know, perfected his craft, and he is quite good as Herman Mankiewicz, as that lead character, as Mank. And, you know, he brings a kind of a sort of pathos to that character. When we first meet Mank in this film, you know, he's recovering from a car crash, and he's dealing with alcoholism. And so that kind of, pathos, I think Oldman really, fleshes out very well. And, again, this Oldman has, you know, been nominated now several times, has won a prior Academy Award. And, I don't necessarily think that he's going to win Best Actor for this performance, because he already, you know, he has an Oscar relatively recently. But he is a kind of a masterful performance in my mind. And, you know, Seyfried is really quite good too. And she, you know, she's also, you know, she's fairly young, but she's been in the industry for a number of years now. And she, also plays, she portrays Marion Davies in a very kind of spirited, but also there's a lot of depth to that performance as well. I think she may have a bit of an edge with that Best Supporting Actress.
Interesting. If we were talking about what wasn't nominated this year, it's interesting to me, Anna, that this is a story of the screenplay written for Citizen Kane, and the screenplay for Mank was written by David Fincher's father, who passed away in the early 2000s, although given a Golden Globe nomination for the screenplay, was left off the nominations for the Academy Awards this year.
Yeah, I know. I was kind of reading about the production history of the film earlier this week, and that is kind of striking. You know, this is a film that Fincher had been wanting to make for decades. In fact, he had planned to make this film right after his 1997 kind of hit The Game. Yeah, it is a little unfortunate that his father wasn't able to kind of see this come to fruition.
Anna Thompson-Hajek is a senior lecturer at the UW-Whitewater and teaches courses in film. We're listening to music from the Oscar-nominated score of Mank, and we'll move on to another Best Picture nominee next, The Trial of the Chicago Seven from Aaron Sorkin. Did you see it? What did you think? 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're listening to music from The Trial of the Chicago Seven. Every Friday in April, The Morning Show takes you to the movies with a look at this year's nominees for Best Picture leading up to April 25th's Academy Awards. If you had a chance to stream The Trial of Chicago 7, would you recommend it? Nominated for 5 Oscars, do you think it's this year's Best Picture? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to the studio, or email us ideas at WPR.org.
He is not represented by counsel.
Overruled.
I am being denied right
Mr.
now.
Seal,
my constitutional will you be quiet? Right for
will
legal
you,
representation.
Will you be quiet?
That was Sir Mark Rylance as William Kunstler, the defense attorney, Yahya Abdul-Mateen as Bobby Seale, and Frank Langella as the judge who oversaw the trial of the Chicago Seven. Another historical film, as we review it with our guest, Anna Thompson-Hajek, who is a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaches courses on film, and she stays with us. And unlike Mank, that really, I thought, could have used the big screen, Anna, I thought The Trial of the Chicago Seven was one of those films that fit nicely on my TV.
Yes, it had a more of a kind of a TV sort of sensibility for sure. And you know that I think that you know Aaron Sorkin is the writer of this screenplay, and you know it's not lost on me that Aaron Sorkin is kind of most well known contribution to film and popular culture is The West Wing. And so, you know, The West Wing is a show and was a political show, much beloved by many, and it's a very talky show. And this film is a very talky film. And so I think, you know, that carries over, right? That's just kind of the style that Sorkin is known for, are these kind of almost like a play where you have these long monologues, for example, and you have you know, this very almost a state. It is a kind of a stagey film in that sense.
And it had a heck of a cast, although there is a nomination for Sacha Baron Cohen as Abby Hoffman in a Best Supporting Role. You had Eddie Redmayne as Tom Hayden. You had Jeremy Strong from Succession Showtime show as Jerry Rubin. Sir Mark Rylance, the British actor, as William Kunstler. You had Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the prosecuting attorney for the federal government, all the way down to Michael Keaton as a former attorney general. It was a big cast. Was Aaron Sorkin able to fit them all in?
You know, that's a good question. It was a big cast. And I think that there were some characters perhaps somewhat underutilized. Michael Keaton, I think, being a good example, you know, he kind of just comes on at the very end and it's just kind of not necessarily used to the best advantage there. But, you know, there are other characters like, you know, Frank Langella plays the judge, a longtime, you know, character actor, and he has some very showy lines that he gets in. And, you know, Cohen, Sacha Baron Cohen, you know, getting that nomination. I'm not necessarily sure Cohen, you know, necessarily has a ton of screen time even. He could have also, I think, been utilized perhaps a little bit more. It's actually Redmayne. I was surprised that did not get the nomination just because Redmayne kind of has.
Oh, dear. I feel like we may have lost Anna Thompson.
Tom Hayden. So, yeah. Tom Hayden, who, you know, comes off as this very idealistic, principled, but also if we want to make change in the world, we have to play, you know, play the game. And he's going up against, you know, the characters of Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, who are much more, have a lot more flair, right, in their sort of dramatic use of the courtroom and one-liners and almost a kind of, they show Cohen doing almost a kind of stand-up or performative art as politics. And I think, you know, Cohen definitely captures that element of Abbie Hoffman's persona, that kind of flair for the dramatic, but also too a little bit of the kind of the principled individual, somewhat troubled as well. So it's a really interesting ensemble cast for sure.
One of the glaring absences in this cast, however, and this has been a running criticism, I believe, of Aaron Sorkin's work, has been a lack of any female characters in the movie. And obviously the defense of that is, well, this is a historical picture. There's only so much you can do with history, but it happens to be something I have heard in the past about Aaron Sorkin's films.
Yes, yes. And, you know, even his work that's just been really highly regarded, I think of, for example, you know, he won the Academy Award for his screenplay of The Social Network. You know, that is an really fascinating film, The Social Network, but the same critique was leveled in that film, you know, where are the women? And, you know, that is something that I think Sorkin, you know, could do a better job with. And I, you know, next week, it's interesting, next week we'll be discussing the two films that are directed by and written by women.
Nomadland and The Promising Young Woman.
Woman, right? This week, of course, we have our traditionalists, our Fincher and Sorkin, right? Who are our sort of industry veterans.
Well, but also, both worked on The Social Network, 2011's best
right.
film. And Fincher was up for best director and lost, but Sorkin won for screenplay. Both of them both up for nominations again this year in those categories.
Right, right. And so there's just that there's some common threads that connect these two men. Even they kind of shared the Trent Reznor who scored the music
and The Social Network.
Right, right. And so, you know, again, these are our industry veterans, our industry deciders, also two white guys, right? And so next, you know, but I do think the Academy is trying to diversify, obviously, their slate of nominees, as evidenced by what we'll be discussing next week. But you're, I think, correct. I think women were certainly underutilized in the trial of the Chicago Seven, for sure. But Mank is a little more interesting because you do have, you know, Seyfried's really interesting performance as Davies. You know, she and Gary Oldman have a really fascinating scene in Mank where they have a kind of almost sort of a walk and talk, you might say, at San Simeon, where, you know, they were each of them kind of reveal their vulnerabilities, their relationship to William Randolph Hearst, which is, you know, interesting, but also obviously, they're dependent on Hearst as well at one point, Mank is referred to as a court jester. You're nothing more than a court jester, right? Mm-hmm. For the pleasure of William Randolph Hearst. And Davies also, you know, she's in a very kind of vulnerable position. And that sort of revealed it really interestingly in that scene in the film.
The two films that we featured today, Mank and The Trial of the Chicago Seven, with our guest, Anna Thompson-Hodgick, senior lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, who teaches courses on film. And Anna, we'll catch up with you next Friday.
Okay, thank you so much.
And coming up, you bet, coming up next Friday and every Friday in April leading up to the Oscars, Anna joins us to discuss two of the Best Picture nominees. And these films have stuck with me. Nomadland and Promising Young Woman are on tap for next Friday. Check out these films this week and join us next week. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.